This is the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about leadership and management with government executives and thought leaders who are truly changing the way government does business. Welcome to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and leadership fellow at the IBM Center for the Business of Government. And today we explore leadership, performance, and the future of service delivery at the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, VA. What does it take to lead one of the largest and most complex service organizations in the U.S. federal government? What are VA's key priorities? How is the department reducing its claims backlog? And what will it take to get the electronic health record modernization right? We'll explore these questions and so much more with Dr. Paul Lawrence, Deputy Secretary at the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. Dr. Lawrence, welcome to the show. It's great to have you.
Hey, Michael. Great to be with you.
So you returned to the Department of Veterans Affairs in its most consequential leadership role outside of Secretary, this time as Deputy Secretary and Chief Operating Officer. Would you tell us more about your role? What drew you back to the department? And how has the department changed since your tenure as Undersecretary for Benefits?
Certainly. Well, you got it right. The Deputy Secretary in the department by law is the Chief Operating Officer. So you're responsible for running things, right? People getting paid or people be able to receive their benefits or doing the day-to-day things. You're also a strategic advisor to the secretary, providing advice, insight, and guidance, and doing those things that he's unable to do by virtue of his schedule. So it's a pretty wide-range job. What drew me back was, of course, our passion for veterans. I think you probably talked to other veterans, and they're like, hey, we really would like to help other veterans. And getting taste of this in Trump's first term really opens your eyes to what's possible. And of course, the president might be one of the most pro-veteran presidents ever, a little bit of an exaggeration, but not by much. And so I knew that his passion for veterans would continue, and this would be a great place to be. We all know that when we left the first term, there were still things on to be done. And so we thought about that for a number of years while we were on sabbatical. So I thought the chance to come back and finish those things that we left undone that we wanted to do and to make things better for veterans was really too great an opportunity to miss.
That's wonderful. So I want to get a sense, given the what are your strategic vision is for the department, and what do you see as the top two or three most urgent priorities demanding attention right now?
Yeah. Well, our strategic vision for the department is to provide veterans world-class healthcare benefits and memorial services. That is our mission, and that's what we want to do. And we use world-class because we really want the experience with us to be excellent. Maybe we never attain that, but we're going to keep trying, and that's part of the point, right, is to really push hard on those things. Way that plays its way out is sort of a couple things, right? We want to make sure veterans have access to care, and when they receive that care, it's really very, very good, right? So, for example, we just looked at some statistics. More than 90,000 veterans are getting care from us than when Trump was inaugurated, right? So we mean access to care, getting veterans the benefits they've earned. Of course, we'll talk later. The new electronic health record is coming to make it better for them. We want to make sure they get their benefits in a timely manner. We'll talk later about this, but we reduced the backlog of claims waiting over 125 days from 260,000 to this morning, 87,000. And we want them to be quick, fast, in a hurry, less than 80 days to get your claim on average. And again, memorial services, we get involved in the American Customer Satisfaction Index, where they benchmark us against other agencies and organizations, and NCA, the National Cemetery Administration, comes out at the very top of that list, regardless of company and sector. So those are the metrics we use. Those are the things we focus on. And in terms of priorities, the secretary is very clear about this. He reminds us all the time of his top priorities. There's six of them, but I'll just tell you about a couple of them, because you might have seen him talk about this one: put veterans at the center of everything we do. Really a North Star, if you will, about focusing on veterans, not on the organization and not on personal agendas. He also talks about things like giving veterans timely access to the benefits and healthcare, giving them choices, challenging the status quo, celebrating and empower employees and holding them accountable, and then some things that are near and dear to him, really working hard to deal with homelessness and veterans in risk of suicide.
You kind of touched on, Deputy Secretary Lawrence, the operational principle for reform, and that is putting the veterans first in everything you do. And I'm wondering, you alluded to it, but I was wondering if you could go a little deeper on how do you define the core mission in operational terms And maybe I could piggyback that with, and what does success look like for a veteran who's engaging VA today compared to, say, 5 years ago?
Certainly. Well, the operational terms are metrics. So here's where we get very granular, and these are often not talked about in public, but at some point, we are a business, right? So we are a business, and so providing benefits, you can measure, you can talk about what our expectations for our employees and see if we adhere to those. And where the connect between your question is, what should those numbers be, is what we hear from veterans directly. The secretary and also me and others, we go out and talk to veterans every chance we can. When I go out for the electronic health record, I'll often spend a night out or a night or two out. And those nights, I'll go to an American Legion or VFW post and hold around a town hall with veterans, talk for a few minutes and take their questions. And listening to those questions, they're telling us what they're interested in. Hey, my claim is taking too long. The forms are confusing. I don't understand. So we have a great feedback mechanism in our veterans, and they guide us as to how to think about those. And so that really is what drives our goals and hence the metrics behind it to make sure we are meeting those. And it really ties to the secretary's point about accountability. If we're going to deliver a service, he talks about us being in a retail business. We have customers. They show up at our facilities. They have expectations. We should be measuring and talking about how we're doing.
That's perfect. So I would like to switch gears, Deputy Secretary, to a topic that is very troubling and seems to be still high, and that is veteran suicide. I'm wondering if you could share with us, what is the department's current strategy to deal with this and mitigate this issue and around prevention? And what do you believe the most promising opportunities, where they lie?
Certainly. Well, we also feel, as you do, Michael, the number is high. And the secretary has been very clear on that. He looks back and says, you know, it's remained high for a long time, and we spent an awful lot of money, and it seems not to be working. So his approach from almost the first day he got here was, what are we doing with all this money, and aren't there better ways to think about it? So he changed out the leadership of our suicide office and is really scrubbing hard on, what are we doing with the money? Are the grants we're giving out, are they having any impact? Are we thinking about alternative ways to approach this problem and the like? So our strategy is to figure out how to involve others, quite frankly. Again, you've heard this whole of government thing, and really looking for other ways. I don't have any results to report right now because, of course, you know, it's a journey, but I think the desire to try new approaches and look to new sources for insight and advice is something that is really dominating our thinking right now.
So another area, Deputy Secretary Lawrence, is veteran homelessness. And that's been a longstanding focus of VA policy and genuine progress over the last 15 years or so. Where does the effort stand today? And more importantly, what is VA's strategy for building on what has worked while addressing the communities and populations where homelessness among veterans seems to be persistent?
Yeah. Again, this is another of Secretary's personal passions. And so we're very proud that in the 1 year we've been here, we house more homeless veterans, almost 52,000, than have been housed in the previous 7 years. So this is something we take very personally. A lot of us, to include me, have been to homeless stand downs where we invite homeless veterans to come and realize, you know, it isn't just a roof over your head. It's all the other services we can get you that help you reintegrate and pursue your American dream. Right? Your veteran status is supposed to help you do this. So we continue to, you know, bring all the forces we can bear. But what's something that's particularly exciting is we're spending a lot of time talking with other agencies about how to do this together. So for example, HUD's deeply involved. We have meetings with them regularly about what can we do together? How do our programs work with your programs? What are the gaps? And also, quite frankly, again, here's where the nonprofits are invaluable. They want to get involved and move the needle too. So we're trying to enlist them in a way that makes sense. So I say we're expanding the community to try to make sure we get this right.
That's great. So switching gears a bit, Deputy Secretary, to the electronic health record monetization initiative, which you have considered and said it's one of your personal priorities. The project has some well-documented challenges. I won't dwell on those, but I was wondering, can we discuss where the initiative is today, where it stands? What is your assessment of what will take to get it right? You know, what can we do? What do you think in the areas of how to improve its implementation?
Yeah, you're right. You're being charitable, Michael. It has a difficult start, and we acknowledge this. The secretary has been very clear when he's gotten questions in hearings. He says, you're right. It's a difficult project. It has not gone where it should have been, and we acknowledge that. From the very beginning, when the secretary got here in February of last year, he convened people, and I would show up about 6 weeks later and said, hey, we have to get this done right. There's no excuse for what's going on. Not only got to get back on the program, because if you remember, it had been paused. The last deployment of the electronic health record had been in 24. So here we were more than a year later and nothing had happened and the pace was too slow. So we got everyone together and said, not only are we restarting, but we are going to accelerate the schedule. So in 2026, we're going to deploy in 13 facilities. Then in 2027, we'll deploy in 26 facilities, and the number will continue to hover between 28 and 30 until by 2031, we've deployed in all our facilities. So the expectations are very, very high. I think there were a series of things that we're missing that are now being applied. Intentional leadership. Secretary's appointed me. The law appoints me to go and do this, and it is my number one priority. As well as sort of aligning our contractors and getting everyone focused on the seriousness of what we're doing. Quite frankly, we can't wait any longer. If we're going to deliver world-class healthcare, we need an electronic health record like what we're buying, so we need to make this work. So it's a real sense across all the levels of this importance. Two is, and this is a little inside baseball, it's like we're going to be standardized on the software. The first efforts in 2018, 19, 20 led to everyone customizing the software and just making a mess out of the whole thing. Okay, so we stopped all that and said, no, we're standardizing around the software. One VA will be one VA, not many VAs. And we're really going to do that and drive our work around the software. And then we're taking this very, very seriously. We involved, you know, everybody we can from all across the department to bring to bear on the very best thinking. And so by the time you listen to this, we'll have gone live at 4 sites in Michigan. And so we'll have real activities and lessons learned to talk to you about in my next appearance.
Absolutely. More than welcome. I'd love to have you back and talk about that. So telehealth has expanded dramatically, obviously, since the pandemic and continues to grow as a care delivery option. I'm wondering, Deputy Secretary, how is VA leveraging telehealth and digital tools to extend access, particularly for veterans in rural or underserved communities, while ensuring that those who prefer to or require in-person care can get it? So what's going on in telehealth?
Yeah, so complicated question. Let me break it apart. Telehealth is really well received. Coming out of the pandemic, I think people got used to it and realized how convenient it can be, and it works for them. So it is more popular than before for the reasons you pointed out. At the same time, we do know people want to come to our facilities. And so if it's not just our facility, which we call direct care, we have just released an RFP to figure out how to rethink and make community care better when we send a veteran into the community. So you have a wide range of options. Again, Secretary would call them choices so that we can get you the care where you need it and you prefer it. The interesting thing about telehealth or digital health is also the availability of technology to support that. So, for example, I just came back from Anchorage several weeks ago. We were talking about the electronic health record, and we had a roundtable with tribal veterans, you know, and the ability for telecommunication to reach where they live is really troubling. And it's not just places like Anchorage, it's other parts of the United States that are just rural, have mountains, or all these different things. So there is a really interesting conversation about, yeah, you'd like to have telehealth or you'd like to have digital health, but the technology doesn't support it. What is, you know, how can we work together to make sure companies realize the opportunities to provide, you know, communication to these parts of the organization, these parts of the country.
Artificial intelligence and data analytics, as you well know, are reshaping government service delivery. I'm wondering, where do you see the greatest opportunities for VA to use AI, whether in claims processing, healthcare delivery, or veteran outreach? And what guardrails are necessary, Deputy Secretary, to ensure these tools serve veterans equitably and accurately?
Yeah, well, I'm really glad you asked about the guardrail, because normally people like hear about the new toy and want to go AI and go, what are we going to do with it, right? And of course, everybody runs around saying everything all the time, everywhere. Okay, but I really do think the second part of your question is really very powerful, Michael. Like, what are the guardrails? Do we really understand what this tool is? And do we appreciate why we're doing it? So I would say we're taking a cautious approach to this. and we are learning from others. So, for example, we're using it in healthcare, where so our providers don't have to transcribe the notes, they can talk, right? They talk, it gets written into the record, that saves time. And when we do process claims, it can gather and assemble information for us, but people still make decisions. So I would say it's promising, but I think that there's still much more thinking to be done. And again, is this balance, right? We want to be able to make sure we are delivering personalized care. We don't want our employees to do rote, mindless work that technology can do for them. But we also understand there's a really big human element to the services we provide, and that's never going to be replaced.
What are the VA's most urgent priorities, and how is success measured? We'll explore these questions and so much more when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Dr. Paul Lawrence, Deputy Secretary of the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. So I'd like to switch gears a bit to benefits delivery, claims modernization, and the PACT Act. And in particular, in your previous tenure, you ran the Veteran Benefits Administration during your first tour. And so you were very familiar. You made so much innovative progress around disability claims processing. I'm wondering, there's a goal for reducing claims backlog that seems fairly significant from, I think, 60,000 by the year end of the year from 238,000 back in 2024. How will VBA achieve this reduction? And is it realistic?
Yeah, well, we're already achieving it. Again, President Trump showed up. The backlog was 265,000. And on average, people were waiting 140 days. That is, by any scale, unacceptable and really not very good. If we were to grade it, you'd be able to give it a really damning grade. Okay. Right now, the backlog is at 87,000, which means we have reduced it by two-thirds. And so it is possible. And we did that with, quite frankly, Michael, fewer employees than the year before. Okay. So we are doing more with less. And quite frankly, it is done with better management, a focus on what really needs to be done with what the veterans tell us needs to be done, and going and doing it and marshaling all our ability, our employees on this goal. And again, you know, average days to complete from 140 to 80 this morning. So you're getting your claim done in 2 months, shorter period of time. Okay. That's what we think needs to be done. Yeah. We want to continue to drive the backlog down because we don't like people saying, I'm waiting for my claim. These are earned benefits. You should be able to access them as quickly as possible. Now, there are some things we have to do that just take energy and time. But you're right. We think the backlog should hover somewhere well below where it is now. We have a goal of 60,000-ish, but it wouldn't surprise me that sort of our sort of running number was somewhere between 70 and 80,000. Just cause. And we think that's kind of a good place to be.
Tremendous reduction. So the PACT Act of 2022 represents the most significant expansion of veteran benefits. I'm wondering, how is VA managing the scale of that expansion operationally? And Deputy Secretary, what are some of the greatest challenges in fulfilling the requirements of the PACT Act?
Yeah, well, the PACT Act was really good law, but I'm not so certain it was all that well thought out. So if you remember when it passed in 2022, they were very proud back then, the previous team, to get started right away, not realizing how much time you actually have to think and plan. So I would draw an analogy to, there was a piece of legislation President Trump signed in middle of 2019 called Blue Water Navy Act with expanded benefits to those veterans in Vietnam who'd been exposed to toxic chemicals who were in the Blue Water Navy, right, 13 miles off the coast of Vietnam. So it expanded the benefit tremendously. What was really good about that and the thinking there was, wait 6 months while you plan. So when the benefits begin on January 1st of 2020, it's been thought out. The rules have been thought out. People have been trained and the like. So when that was done in 2020, it really had no effect on processing because people had thought through how to do it. If you remember in 2022, they were all so excited to get started. They really began without thinking about it. And they learned along the way. And so the backlog jumped to over 400,000. Okay. And they fiddled and diddled, and slowly they were bringing it down to 265 when we showed up. So a lot of the thinking has taken place over time. And right now we're in the process of sort of working off some of the things that came with it. So it was good legislation, addressed a really big need. We're glad, you know, we appreciate when Congress recognizes the contribution of veterans and awards benefits. But I always remind people that, you know, it isn't enough to award benefits. You actually have to think about how to administer the benefits. Because when you make a promise to veterans and you don't think about how you're going to deliver, you breed distrust. And so that's something I feel very, very strong about. Promises to veterans about awarding of benefits have to come with some thinking and maybe some additional resources around how that's going to be done.
It's so true, Dr. Lawrence, because these laws, these acts fail because the implementation is not thought through. And it's so fascinating to see that. So, you know, switching gears a bit, VA is in the midst, is it fair to say that VA is in the midst of one of the most significant organizational restructurings in history? Is that a fair statement? And I'm wondering.
That's right. The Veterans Health Administration is being reformed, right? We're trying to streamline it and take out some of the middle layers of management. And what's really interesting about this, Michael, is this has been stuff that people have been writing about for, I'm going to be imprecise here, but not by much, 30 years, right? GAO, the IG, Congress, probably NAPA studies is left. And so for the first time, we're actually doing it. And so you're right. That's what we're undertaking, is streamlining to get more veterans, more of our employees to be able to deliver care to veterans and less bureaucracy.
And how are you approaching this challenge to ensure this happens? Is there a strategy you could outline for us a little bit?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's very much focused on some business thinking, so it isn't totally invented out of whole cloth, right? Again, we run the largest hospital chain probably in the world, but certainly in the United States. Others run, you know, somewhat similarly large hospital operations. They've had thinking about, you know, what's the relationship between the top of the organization and those who deliver care? How many layers should there be? How should the geography be organized? So we are embracing many of those best practices, as well as inviting our team to participate in how they're really thought out. So again, using a business model with, you know, sessions with our employees to give us guidance on some of the particulars, we're trying to get the sort of best of both worlds, if you will.
Yeah. So I'm thinking about how are you doing with your daily portfolio? And I know you're busy. Your time is very tight. But how are you instilling or building, Deputy Secretary, a culture of accountability and continuous improvement in the organization, given the size and complexity of VA as a whole?
Yeah. So the accountability is pretty straightforward. It's hard, but it's pretty straightforward. The Secretary talks about it all the time. And he's very clear on when things go wrong, I mean horrifically wrong, we should figure out why that happened and how it happened. And if someone's accountable, deal with that, both good and bad, right? He passes out many more, you know, upside, right side smiley faces than downside ones, you know? So we really, now that gets driven into our HR system. So this year we've just spent a lot of time talking about personnel evaluations. What are we measuring and why? Who's accountable? And are we really being firm graders? Last year, before we showed up, 94% of the people in VA got the highest grade on the government evaluation. You know, it's a 5-scale thing, 1 to 5. 94% of the folks got 5s. That's sinful, okay, and certainly can't be true. So we're taking things like that very seriously to making sure we link performance to rewards so that we recognize, quite frankly, and I think you can appreciate this because I know you talk to a host of people. Everybody comes to public service, not so much for the money, but they want to have an impact and they want to contribute. And the vast majority of public servants are outstanding. But we really dishonor them when we don't deal with poor performers. So we can't say, oh yeah, we embrace public service. Well, wait a minute, you can't tell the difference between the joggers and the sprinters. I mean, that's a real problem and we're dealing with that.
Yeah, that echoes a conversation I had with Scott Cooper a couple of weeks ago regarding that issue. Staying with workforce, Deputy Secretary, you would agree that the workforce at VA is one of its greatest assets. How are you thinking about workforce development, morale, retention in this period of transformation? And what is your message to VA employees about the path ahead?
Yeah. So we think about it a lot. You're exactly right. We have 441,000 people with us, and we know that is the moment that really matters to veterans, the service delivery, right? Your interaction with your provider, doctor, nurse, whoever, your interaction with our process to get benefits, you know, your interaction during a difficult period of your life when you come to have memorial services with us. We know our employees really, really matter. So we want to make sure we have just the most amazing workforce ever. Top talent. We recruit aggressively. We want people to really want to come to VA and be, you know, be envious of their friends who have jobs here. We want that to be true. We also know we're going through a period where we are transforming, where we are doing some of the things I talked about, which is dealing with the bureaucracy and some folks who maybe shouldn't be here. So we want our message to be clear. We value you here as long as you are focused solely on delivering for veterans. We value you here if you want to be very excellent at that. And we value you here because we think this mission is important. So that's our message. We're recruiting all the time and we get a lot of applications because I think people really are compelled by the mission. They have a veteran in their family. They were a veteran. They know the value of veterans. It's a pretty cool mission. So we think it's a great place to work. And for those listening, you know, we always are advertising jobs, va.gov or USA Jobs. So if they're interested, you know, it's probably a place for you.
That's wonderful. So you admit that VA does not operate in isolation. What I mean by that, Deputy Secretary, is effective VA service requires deep coordination with, say, the Department of War on transitions, the Department of Labor on employment, HUD, Housing and Urban Development on housing, and a range of other agencies and community partners. I'm wondering if you could share with us your approach or the VA's approach to those interagency relationships, and where do you see the greatest opportunities to strengthen them?
Certainly. Oh, you're absolutely right. In fact, you probably could have gone through the whole cabinet and found some connection between us and them, VA and them. And I regularly talk about this. There are regular meetings of the deputies of the cabinet agencies where we actually have these conversations. How are we working together? And like, the natural way to think about it is our relationship with the Department of War. I mean, think about it. Secretary talks about sort of like, you know, we're cousins, right? You'll grow up in the Department of War, and then you'll become a veteran. And so we want to make sure that journey is seamless, right? Electronic health record is a good example. And that folks realize we need both. We need a great Department of War, but also we need a great Department of VA to provide services that they earn while they're in the Department of War. So we do that. We do that through something called the JEC, the Joint Executive Committee. I chair that with the Undersecretary for P&R over at DOW. And we coordinate on issues regularly. I know from before that a lot of that coordination was very formal and not really happening. I've never felt the collaboration between DOW and VA is as high as it is now than ever before. We talk, if not daily, certainly weekly about issues. We talk about things we need to do together to just make sure that whole experience for veterans and service members is great. Part of what we talk about is exactly what your question alluded to. How do they transition out into great jobs? How do we make sure they have connections with VA and they understand what VA can play in their life in terms of a college education, no money down home, and all these different things? So active conversations with them and many, many other agencies to make sure. And I'd say, how do we do it? Is we continue to collaborate. We be aggressive about talking about how to connect with VA and what the veteran journey is and what part the different agencies play in it.
So, Deputy Secretary Lawrence, I want to talk about your first tour, or some of the lessons learned when you were at VA Undersecretary for Benefits. You oversaw the delivery of more than $100 billion in direct benefits annually and led the implementation of the landmark Veterans Appeal Modernization Act. As you look back, what were the defining management lessons from that experience, and how do you use those lessons to inform how you're working in your current role?
Certainly. Well, I'll tell you a funny story, then I'll break into this. So you finally get confirmed. You go through this whole process, whatever. They make a big announcement. They swear you in. And I remember thinking, okay, one of the things someone had told me once in some of the conversations, not unlike this, it's like, hey, what'd you do your first day? And they said, I went through the whole building and shook everybody's hands. And I said, that's a pretty good idea. So at the Veterans Benefits Administration on that day, in the main office in Washington, don't forget there's like 56 offices around the country, so it's not everybody, right? But of the probably 24,000 employees at that time, I'll say 4,000 of them were in the building, right, across multiple floors. So with some guide, I walked through and shook people's hands all day, all afternoon one day. And what I was surprised by, how many people said, who are you? And so I thought, well, gee, I would have thought that might have been something that got out. So my first lesson was communication is really important. And no matter how much you've done, you probably could do more. So it was really a lesson about communication. Then what followed was sort of something we've talked about was, what are we doing here? Are the goals set right? How are we measuring those goals? And how are we talking about our performance of those goals? And I don't mean just once a year. How about every day? And why don't we encourage people to talk about the problems so we can fix them in advance? So it was very powerful lessons about management at a very large scale, about the importance of data and the importance of communicating where we are, where we're going, and how we're doing. And so while it was easy to think about the frustrating moments, it was really rewarding to think about, while it happened, and also a reflection, the things that did get accomplished, right? The Appeals Modernization Act was delivered on time. The Forever GI Bill, you know, was delivered once we reset the schedule on time, right? Blue Water Navy was delivered on time. So it was a great team, and it just took sort of framing and a little like redirection.
That's great. I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you this question because it's been on my mind for a while. I was hoping you could share with us your leadership philosophy. What principles do you follow and how do you follow them?
Yeah, well, this is pretty straightforward. I think it's very important that leaders articulate why we're all together doing what we're doing. And this, I guess Simon Sinek would have called it the why, right? What are we doing here? Okay. So articulate, then communicate what it means to everybody, right? So you're processing claims and we expect you to do 10 of these a day. And the reason why you're doing that is because this is related directly to our why, which is to serve veterans, for example, okay? And then to measure, right? And oh, by the way, 10 a day means 10 a day and we check every week. And if you're not doing 10 a day, we're going to check probably every day and figure out if you need more training and determine what it's going to take, right? So articulate, communicate, and measure. Those three things, regardless of where I find myself, is what sort of makes sense to me. Because I think part of the problem is we often go to measure and want to penalize people. Could be they don't understand, they're not certain what's expected of them and the like. So that's how they work together. And often when I've seen problems elsewhere, within, you know, VA more broadly, I wonder and I research to like, are all three of those elements there and do folks understand it?
That's great. So before I close, I had a question about the future. I know you can't prognosticate, but where do you see the department going over the next few years? And more importantly, what are the structural forces in your mind that will most shape VA's evolution?
Yeah. Well, we're going to continue to get better. So if you had asked me sort of what's on the plate, right? So I could go through the 25 accomplishments around about backlog and delivery of care and opening new facilities and housing homeless people. That's 25. In 26, you see us talking about the reform of VHA, the electronic health record modernization, and the big new RFP for community care. Once those are in place, what you see us doing now is preparing to deliver better care to veterans faster, right? A reorganized VHA, less tail and more tooth, if you say, right? Better care through the electronic health record, faster benefits and the like. So we want to continue to improve and make sure our veterans know VA is here for you. Yeah, there'll be some external forces. Congress passes legislation based on things they think we should do. But in many ways, I think it's really all on us as leaders to drive the organization to fulfill the promises, you know, Lincoln made, you know, so long ago, right, is to really provide veterans the benefits they've earned in, you know, in a way that makes sense, quick, fast, and hurry, timely, high quality, and helpful to their pursuit of what they want to do after service.
So one last question, you may have touched on it just now, but what do you want veterans and their families to know about your personal commitment to this work? And why, to the American public, how can you convey to them what VA means and how important it is?
Yeah. Well, a personal commitment is like, I'm one of so many veterans who are here who believe strongly in our mission to help veterans get things they've earned. And the secretary talks about, you know, veterans don't get benefits, they've earned benefits. And these are available to anybody who volunteers in the military and serves honorably. So this is a powerful promise we are executing on behalf of the American public through Congress. That's really our focus. And it's like so many others here, that's what we intend to do. I would just say, you know, folks listening, you know, if you'd like to come work at VA, you're interested in our mission, again, va.gov is a great place. You know, one of the things we're really passionate about, you know, there's 17-ish million veterans in the United States. only about 9 million of them access our healthcare. We know good things happen to veterans when you connect with us. So folks listening to this, if you're connected, tell your friends who are not connected with us, Michael, of your audience, hey, I'm a veteran, but I've never gone to the VA, never thought. Please connect with us. There's something here that you've earned that we're involved with. It might not be benefits. You know, you can volunteer and help other veterans. We're here. We encourage all veterans to connect with the VA because we think it's a great community, and it's a community they've earned the right to belong to.
Deputy Secretary Lawrence, I want to thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule and joining me. It was a real honor having you on. But more importantly, I'd like to thank you for your dedicated service to the country.
Thanks so much, Michael. I look forward to coming back and talking about some of our successes in 2026.
This has been the Business of Government Hour, a conversation with Dr. Paul Lawrence, Deputy Secretary of the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. Be sure to join us next time for another informative, insightful, and in-depth conversation on improving government leadership and its effectiveness. Until then, subscribe, download, and listen to the entire interview at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Audible, or on your favorite podcast app. And as always, at businessofgovernment.org. For the Business of Government Hour, I'm Michael Keegan, and thanks for joining us.